Well, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate you being here tonight. Thank you very much for coming out. We are in Genesis chapter 12 again. We've got some of the notes from last week. I pulled a few of them off, but we begin in chapter 12, verse 1 through 9. I'll just read in the NIV what it says here, and then we'll have the notes in the English Standard Version. So Genesis chapter 12, 1 through 9. The Lord had said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you." And then he makes a promise. "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And the peoples on and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So Abram left, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran, and he took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all the possessions they had accumulated and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Morah at Shechem. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he went on toward the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. Then Abram set out and continued toward the Negev. Now a map I've got of this for you to see, and we'll refer to it several times, is on page 11 of just the journey coming from Haran, coming down through Hazor. Or Dan, Hazor, Megiddo, and then Shechem. And then you can see right there, Ai and Bethel are just off to the east side of Bethel, or Shechem. And then he goes down into the Negev. The Negev is a sandy wilderness area in the desert area in southern Canaan, or southern Israel. And you can see two cities that are underlined there, Hebron and Beersheba. And those are going to be major cities for Abram. And then we're going to have some other maps coming up here. On page 1 of the notes, right there at the top, chapter 12, verse 1, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you.'" So he's coming down into the land of Canaan. We'll just draw very quickly the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. And he's going to come up. This would be Dan up into this area. He's going to go by. I showed you a picture of a gate from Abraham's time that is still there, and it's a little bit further north than that. He comes down through the Megiddo Valley, past Megiddo would be right in here. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's Mount Carmel. And then down into this area right here is going to be the land of, or the city of Shechem that he's going to come to. I do have for you to see a picture that we'll refer to several times. And you might as well see it now on page 8. There's a picture of Shechem, or part of Shechem. You can see on the left side, there's a mount here. It would be Mount Gerizim on this side. And over on this side is Mount Ebal. And you recognize probably right away, that's where, when Joshua came across, they came into Shechem, right there probably. You can see that the stone formation there, Baal Bereth, is a temple fortress. There is a standing stone still there. I've got a little line. It's a black and white photo. You can see it better online. I've got some video of it. I'm going to try to put that together. But there's a standing stone there. That used to be a temple. It's been a holy place, apparently, from before the days of Abraham. Abraham's going to come to that location, and we'll read about what he's going to do there. But then he's going to go from there over here to a place in an area between Bethel and Ai. Now I'm getting kind of far south right here. I'm going to move my Dead Sea down here as if right here, because Shechem is 35 miles north of Jerusalem. And Bethel and Ai, he's going to come here, and then from there he's going to go down into the Negev area. That is the journey he's going to be going on. But back to page 1. The people that he's leaving, I think we referred to this last week, coming out of Haran and Ur, north of that, was Terah, Abraham's brother Nahor, who has a son named Laban. They were idol worshipers, and that's in Joshua 24:2. It says, Joshua said to the people, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, long ago your fathers lived beyond the Euphrates, Terah, the father of Abram and Nahor, and they served other gods." That's referred to in chapter 24 of Joshua. Laban's household had gods in Genesis 31. Rachel steals the household gods and has them with her when she comes back. You can see Stephen refers to this. I'm not sure if I got it. Yeah, and on page 2.3, Acts 7, verses 2 through 4, Stephen's sermon, he says that God appeared to his father, to the father Abraham in Haran, and he says, "The God of glory appeared to the father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran, and said to him, 'Go out from your land and from your kindred and go to the land that I will show you.' Then he went out from the land to the Chaldeans and lived there." So he's going to be leaving the people. Oh, and you see the names of the people going back to point two. Terah, it sounds like the name, it's Yera, which it means moon, and that was the moon god. They worshipped Sin, the name Sin, not for like sinning, but that was just the name of the god Sin. And they worshipped him clearly there in Ur and Haran. Sarai means princess, or is equivalent to the word Seratu, which means queen, which is another reference to the moon god's consort. Nahor married his niece Milcah, whose name means goddess, was named after that, one of the moon god's goddesses, or Akkadian for queen again. Laban means white. We referred to that last week because the moon was white when a full moon, as we've seen lately the last week. And so all of their names were wrapped up into the moon god and the religion that came out of that area. And both Ur and Haran were known for being moon worshipers, that they had temples and shrines to that. So there's no difference, nothing unique about that. They were idol worshipers. And it's going to come up again in some of these verses we'll see tonight. Looking at point 4, Genesis 15:7, God speaks to Abram, and he said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess." So he's bringing Abram out of Ur and Haran, or Ur of the Chaldeans, and bringing him down into this land and for him to possess. Now, one of the first verses we're going to look at, it's going to say, when he's at Sechem, it's going to say, "And the Canaanites were in the land." This land is lived in by the Canaanites. The Canaanites is not necessarily one specific group, but includes the Amorites and a variety of other Hittites and others that are living in here. But they are in the land at that time. That's going to be referred to. Point 5, it says, "Go from," or "get out," is a translation of the Hebrew leka, which means literally "go yourself." This Hebrew phrase indicates urgency. I mean, because it's repeated, it means go, you need to get out now. We've got, well, first of all, he's 70 and then 75 years old as the story begins. And so he's got a lifespan, but it is time for him to go, and God's beginning his plan. If you look at point 11 on page 3, we're going to come back to these other ones. Abram is going to be a new beginning. We had a beginning with Adam, was a beginning, and then the tree, the sin, that ended that, and he went through 9 generations, and that declined into chaos before the flood. And so then Noah, God flooded the earth, and Noah was a new beginning. This declined into many peoples who then are going to group together as one instead of nations, and God has to end this with the Tower of Babel. So Adam, the first beginning, is stopped and has to be destroyed. Noah, their plan after Noah was to unite at the Tower of Babel, and that was confusion was set in. And that's exactly where Abraham picks up. Abraham, understand this story, Abraham, or Abram, is God's response to the Tower of Babel. Everything the Tower of Babel wanted to attain, God is going to do that to Abraham, but keep it in one nation. But through that nation, he's going to bless all the other nations. So God had to stop the human race for what they're doing at Babel by dispersing them. But he's not just giving up on them. He is then taking one individual and going to unravel or undo what he did at Babel. But he's got to first get the plan of salvation into the earth, and he's going to do that through Abram. And so point 11, the new beginnings so far have been Adam, which ended with the fall of man, Noah, which ended at the Tower of Babel, and then Abram, the nations of the earth will be blessed then through him. going back to point seven, there's these commands he's told to get out of the land. That's the first thing he says is leave this land and go out of your country. That would be Ur and then Haran. It's basically the Aram-Syria area. And then we talked about that. It could be down southern Ur, down in Mesopotamia in the south. Or it could be the northern Ur, which is still Mesopotamia, the land between the river. The story just makes sense biblically if it's the northern Ur, because that's where Jacob goes, that's where Isaac gets his wife from, is the northern. You don't have to accept that. This is the first time I've actually taught it that way. But as I've read this, all of a sudden the Bible just seems to make sense. That's where he keeps going back to his family, and his family is from that area. So if you don't accept that, that's fine. Think about Ur in the south. All your Bible maps have that. I've got a big chart on my wall, big map I've had since the 80s of Abraham's journey from Ur. It's down south, down by the Persian Gulf. So either way. But he's supposed to leave the land, whichever land it is, he's to get out of the land. And then I got some information there about where I think that land's at. But this land, he's supposed to also leave his relatives, which would mean his family, and his father's household. So land, family, and household. In other words, this is a complete break. I mean, imagine leaving your land where you were born, and then leaving your people, your race, if you would, and then even leaving your father's household. I mean, you have no connections. I mean, at least you've got a land, and I've got a country. Well, at least I've got a race. Okay, well now, at least I've got my father's family. I've still got relatives, and I've got an inheritance. I'm connected. It's like, no, you're even leaving that. It's like Abram is going out and is starting at ground zero with nothing. No inheritance, nothing. He's got stuff, and that's going to lead to the blessing. We'll see that in a minute, how blessed Abraham is, and we'll talk about that. But in other words, he's leaving land, relatives, father's household, and on page two, under C, father's house, it means this was the strongest bond that provided social and economic life. Socially, economically, Abraham is starting from zero. Abraham is leaving his natural inheritance and the stability of the promised inheritance and the stability the Lord will provide. The Lord is going to now have to replace all those, and he says, I will too, I'll take care of that. Now, again, be careful with all this. I remember being in the 80s, I was in different churches and a denomination and a theology that would always take all these things that God said to Abraham and then instantly just, you could transfer them to yourself. You know, well, God says he's going to bless Abraham and do all these things for Abraham, and so you too are like Abraham. It's like, no, you're not Abraham. Abram is very unique. You got the entire world right here. He takes one guy. He said, I'm going to make an entire nation out of you, and I'm going to bless the entire world through you. So be very careful, especially when you get in again, I don't want to start naming names or groups, but they'll take this and make it sound like you too can be Abram. It's like, now you can find verse where God is talking to, you know, the general believer or the plan as a believer in Christ, but he's doing something. He's changing, redirecting history with Abram. And what he promises to do to Abram is you just can't take that as your own promise. You can. God had a plan for Abram. He had a purpose for Abram. You can say, well, God's got a plan and purpose for me. That's part of being created in God's image and being in Christ. You've got a gift. You've got a plan. But be careful, because Abraham's going to have things happen to him that, I mean, no one else in history is going to have these kind of things. Well, first of all, his seed is going to bless the entire world. He's going to produce Christ. So, I mean, obviously, that's off the record. That's already been taken. So just be careful with this. This is a new alliance is going to be formed, meaning God is working in our lives with our land, our nation, within our race, our people, within our families. Now, he can work outside of that too, but you don't have to leave your family. You don't have to leave your race. You don't have to leave your country. I mean, that's now a separate calling. This is what Abraham's calling him to do, to go to an entire different land. I could, in my own life, describe my Christian experience of growing up in a Christian home, and they came sometime when we were 25, Tony and I were married, that we set out on our own spiritual journey, and we left our you know, our family, our home, we just went down and started over in pursuit of God. And again, we followed a pattern, something like this, but it wasn't like God was telling me to do and follow Abraham. But there is that time of God will separate you and lead you different places. But it's hard to say follow Abraham or follow me or follow somebody as God leads you. But, you know, there is a time where God can separate you and give you something you weren't expecting. And again, it was a, just like Abraham, it's going to be a journey. It was a journey for myself and Tony as we struggled and faced many obstacles. But in the end, God was leading us somewhere. And I think God's leading all of us in our own life. But be careful when you start running a pattern on this, because we're not doing the same thing Abram's doing, although God will lead you and guide you. Okay, point 9 on page 3, Abram was going to be given his own land, his own territory, his own national property, a country. Abraham would not be a nomad or a sojourner. He was going somewhere that he would eventually, this land was going to be his family's land. Now, he was going on a journey. He would wander in the land, but eventually, especially with Moses and Joshua, that nation was going to be established. So what began with Abram of going into this land, this is where this whole story is going to go tonight. What is going to go, Abraham's going to go through and set up altars. And we've got to talk about the altars. When he sets an altar up at Shechem, I'm going to get rid of Mount Ebal right there. It looks like an A in front of Shechem. Shechem, he's going to set up an altar. He's going to go across right over here to between Bethel and Ai and set up another altar. But there's no sacrifices. It doesn't say any offered sacrifice. Now, you build an altar, you're going to offer a sacrifice. Abraham is recorded as only offering one sacrifice, and that's out on Mount Moriah. That's Isaac, which ends up being replaced with a ram. That's the only offering or sacrifice that Abram makes in the book of Genesis. Now, you can think about that. I disagree with it. I think there's, now he builds altars. But these altars possibly, and I think as you read the text, they're more like claims of land. He builds an altar, and this altar is, he's this, and he's claiming this. He goes down to Shechem, and then in Beersheba and Hebron, he does it again. Mine, mine, mine. He's claiming the land with these altars. When we unravel it, Jacob's going to go to the same place, do the similar things, and when Joshua comes in, he's going to reverse it and come in. He goes to Jericho. But the first place he goes after Jericho, it's just a story in Joshua. The fall of Jericho, yay, he's in the land. But then they decide they're going to go where? Where's the first place they go? The very first place they go and invade after the entrance to Jericho, they go to Ai, right here. And they say, that's a small city, won't take much. And they're defeated at Ai. And then they've got to regroup, ask God what happened. You know, Laban, stole the Babylonian garment. Achan. Achan, thank you. I knew that name, but it's like, you know, the old mind. But, you know, they're defeated. Then they come back and they defeat Ai. And from there, they go right up to Shechem between Mount Ebal and Gerizim at Shechem at the same place. That's where they renew the vows. And then they begin to spread out from there. So this is all going to be repeated. Abraham is the one that's coming. He's not going to have a nation. You know, when the nation shows up with Moses, the lawgiver, where he sets up the nation. He sets up the structure of the nation. There are Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, the 12 sons, and all those years of captivity, or not captivity, but in Egypt that ends up in slavery. They're just a people, growing as a people. Then Moses comes and establishes them as a nation, writes their constitution. And then Joshua leads them into the land, and now they become a physical reality of what God had promised Abraham. So this is going to take generations. Remember, God says, this land, I'm giving you this whole land, but first, and eventually we'll get there, I think it's chapter 15, you're going to become a people, and you're going to have to go to Egypt, and you'll be kept in Egypt for four generations and end up being slaves because the sin of the Amorites is not yet full. They're here. He's just scouting out. He doesn't kill anybody, Abram. He doesn't take anybody's land from him. In fact, he purchases land. He's buying land. He's going to buy a cave of Machpelah down there in Hebron. That's where they still have Abraham's tomb, Sarah's tomb, Jacob's buried there. I've never been there. It's under occupation. I couldn't get there. But I think you could, but I didn't have the right connections. But it's not until Joshua comes in with already having a law, constitution, a governmental system, that he takes the land. So Abraham is just going to be the beginning of a long process. What else is here? Okay, let's go to chapter 12, verse 2. And I will give you, this is what he's told him to do so far. Abraham is to leave his land, his relatives, and his father's household. His people, his father's household. Leave everybody, you're going to become an entire new race. So now if he does that, here's the promise. Chapter 12, verse 2. And he's going to give him six, in a sense, promises. I want to rush through this because I don't want to be spending another week on this. I will make you into a great nation. Let me erase this. And if you'll leave this land, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Now, Abraham does not become a nation himself. Like I said, that's going to be Moses' job. Next, I'll make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. Two, bless. And three, it says, and I'll make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. Name great. Abram's name, or Abraham's name, is going to be great. And you will be a blessing. Now, this right here, if it's amazing, this is what the Tower of Babel wanted. They wanted to make a Shem for themselves, a name for themselves. But Nimrod, eventually he's going to do it, but Nimrod becomes a tyrant. He doesn't become a blessing. God is going to give Abraham the great name, the thing Babel wanted, and they're going to begin just dominate. Abraham's going to get the great name. But instead of being a tyrant and dominating, Abraham's going to be a blessing. And at this bless right here, this is a promise of, it's in the notes, two things. Blessing can mean, we'll just say children, because I can spell that, and it can mean wealth. Now, up in here, when it talks about a great nation, that already is referring to people. He's not going to conquer some area and take these people as his captives. He's going to produce a race, his own people, his own genetics will produce the people. So this right here, the nation, is a promise of people. So that means when he says, and I will bless you, since this is the people, the other way they could be blessed in the ancient world in their understanding, we would think we're blessed if we have peace and we have, you know, harmony with nature, and we have a sound mind or whatever. To them be blessed, you had a large family and you had possessions. That would be the simple way God will bless you. It would be, well, I just feel blessed in my heart. It's like that's not what they're talking. They're talking about physical, this great nation. So this blessing right here has to refer to wealth or possessions. I'll draw a dollar sign there. That is what he's referring to there. This is, you leave your land, you leave your race, your people, you leave your father's household and your entire inheritance, and you just go to the land I'm going to show you. And when you get here, you're going to become a great people, a great nation of your own. The nations were all scattered, but I'm going to make another one out of you. I will bless you. You can't walk away from as much as I'm about to give you. So walk away. And your name will be great. What Babel wanted to do and make a name for themselves, I'm going to do that with you, Abram. You're going to be the name. And then when you become that, you will be not a tyrant, not a king, not a dictator. You will be a blessing. And that's what is being said right there in that verse. And we'll come back and look at the notes there. Go to page 5, chapter 12, verse 3. And going on, and I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in all the and in you all the families on earth will be blessed. So number 5 is it is, and I will bless those who bless you. So anyone who cooperates with you will get the same blessing. They're going to get the same thing. I'll treat you the same way. Those who bless you, I will bless. And again, you should notice this, and you don't see it in the English necessarily, but if you look at the word those who bless you, that word, meberekecha, that is in the second person masculine, but that is in, oh, there it is. I can't say it for you, but it's in the plural. You see, MPC, that is in the plural. But when you go to the next one, the sixth one, and him who curses you, I will curse, that is in the singular. So this right here, those who bless you, and that is those. That is, there will be plural, people will bless you. There'll be groups blessing you. But if there is an individual, someone that dares step up and curses you, and again, if you notice right there as I'm going through this, I'll come back and give you more detail on it. But the word in the Hebrew, it's word 7043 in the Strong's. I can try to pronounce it for you if you wanted me to. But it is kelel, or kalel. It means to be small, to be insignificant, to be slight, to be trifling. So that means anyone who considers you small or insignificant or to slight you or to consider you, if there's any one single individual that would in any way consider you a trifle, a small, irrelevant, then I will curse that individual. So the blessing is, and I will bless those, plural, who bless you. And that individual, if any one person considers you small, insignificant, or slight, I will curse. And that word curse, if you notice right there in the numbers, it's 7043 on curse you, if they curse you, Abram. And the number is 779, completely different word, for I will curse. It doesn't say those who consider you small, I'll consider them small. And it doesn't say those who bring you destruction, I will bring you destruction. It's those who even consider you insignificant or small or don't recognize your greatness, I will utterly curse them. So you see, it's not like one for one. It's not eye for eye or, you know, ear for ear. It's if they disregard what I'm doing with you, they'll utterly be cursed. Which is, it's right there in the Hebrew. You can see it right there. Two different words, and you can see the difference between plural, those who bless you, the multitudes who bless you, I will bless just like I blessed you. But if there is one single individual who considers you insignificant, doesn't take you serious, I will utterly curse them, that individual. I mean, that's what is being pointed out there. In the English, it's read, I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. But one's plural, one's singular, and one is a difference in the girl. Okay, but then number seven, the last one, I'll write curse right here. And number seven, and this is the ultimate goal, because this is a response to God's activity or his destruction, confusion at the Tower of Babel. All those people have been sent out around the world. Their technology has been slowed down. Their communication has been broken down. Everyone is going to become a nation, an island unto themselves. They can't pool together. They just war with each other. They can't communicate. Any technology they develop over here on this side of the world doesn't understand it yet. And they develop something, no one else knows about it. It's just going to slow the whole process of, again, why? Because man is made in God's image. He's got incredible potential. Man is fallen, but he still has God's image about him as far as being creative and being able to develop. So the Tower of Babel dispersed man, confused them. It's going to slow them down. Now, God said, my plan is I'll work it through Abram, and I'm going to make you your own nation. I will bless you, referring to wealth. We'll see that again. Your name is going to be great, not the Tower of Babel. You will be a blessing, not a tyrant like Nimrod. Those who bless you, they'll also be blessed. But if anyone considers what I'm doing for you insignificant, they're utterly cursed. And seven, you will bless all those nations I've cursed. You're going to bless them, and we're going to do what I want, and we're going to eventually bring them back together. He doesn't say this, but you can see they'll all be blessed. I'll just read it. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So what the Tower of Babel wanted to do was not going to be bless all the people. It was going to be bring everyone together, get all their resources with fallen man, and that would lead to, well, it'd lead to disaster. It'd lead to destruction. It'd lead to oppression, tyranny, slavery. But he's got to break that down. And now we're going to reverse it. And eventually it's going to become, you know, Jesus is going to become the one who's going to come and resolve the Tower of Babel. But actually, that goes all the way back to Genesis 3 with the fall of man, the seed of the woman who's going to deliver man from the power of Satan, the power of death, from sin itself. So again, he's reversing the Tower of Babel through Abram to bring Jesus. But Jesus ultimately going to work. God's plan goes all the way back to the fall, which is, again, a rather exciting story, an account. And realize this, now again, sometimes when I've read Genesis or I study Genesis or you just understand, you know, what's in there, you see chapter, you know, 1 and 3, 1 through 4 kind of, you know, creation story in Adam and Eve. Then you've got these genealogies, and then, of course, then there's the story of Noah's flood, and then there's the story of the Tower of Babel. And then, well, and then what happens? Oh, then there's a guy named Abraham. And then you got all the rest of the books about Abraham. Well, now you see it's all connected. Man was created, he falls, he becomes chaotic, destructive. God has to wipe him out, start again with Noah. Noah's families begin to reach together and become the Tower of Babel. They're going to be in a sinful state, going to create something that God says, not going to create that on your own, disperses them. And Abraham comes in to deliver them from not the curse of the Tower of Babel, but the confusion of the Tower of Babel. And he's got to take a process to go through that. So going back to these notes on page 4, page 3. First, the promise of a land included a second dimension, which was a highly populated nation. Goy is the Hebrew word. This would naturally include a political establishment. He says, I will make you a great nation. It's going to have to include a political establishment, a common land, a common language, a common government. And again, Abraham's going to see none of that. He's just going to be a family that's, well, you know, he's going to have Isaac, and then Jacob's going to start having children. But all of that, the political system, the land, the language, the government, what God began with Abram would be inherited and established with Moses. Moses is the one who is the lawgiver. He's the one who establishes the national, and it continues yet today. It continues yet today. So that was, again, the establishment of nations. Second, the land will bless Abraham. And again, the word for blessing refers to manifestation in two areas, descendants and material wealth. And since that first one, descendants, is included in the ideal of a nation, it refers specifically, most likely, to wealth. You don't need to worry about your father's inheritance. You're going to be fine. And here it is a list, on page 4, point B3, Abraham's experience with material wealth. Are you ready? Here it is. Chapter 12, verse 5, he enters Canaan with possessions, because that 5 years that he was in Haran, they gained possessions and people. So he leaves Ur, goes to Haran for 5 years, and when he's up and leaving, he's already gained from his time. Chapter 12 and 16 and 20, he gains livestock from Pharaoh. In a sense, he kind of disobeys. He leaves the land, he lies about his wife, Pharaoh gets in trouble, Pharaoh gets mad at Abraham, but yet, in that whole process, if you want to say those were mistakes, or Abraham being scared, or being faithless, or being stupid, or whatever happens, he's sent out of the land by Pharaoh with more stuff. Chapter 13, Lot and Abraham have grown so big and so powerful, they have to separate. The land can't contain their wealth. Now, you can imagine having so much wealth that there's not enough room in West Des Moines for all my stuff. Then having a nephew who also has so much stuff, it's like, listen, we got so much stuff. We got so many cattle. West Des Moines can't. You've got to go somewhere else. Listen, I'll stay in West Des Moines if you want to go, you know, over to Iowa City. Or if you want to stay here, I'll go to Iowa City. But one of us has to leave. And it's not because we're fighting with each other. It's just, you've got grocery stores and I've got grocery stores. You've got gas stations and I've got gas stations. Our economy just keeps collapsing in on itself. So which way do you want to go? So Lot chooses what he thinks is the best land, which is down towards Sodom and Gomorrah, the plain. We'll talk about that later. And Abraham stays here. So that's how many possessions they've got. He leaves with possessions, gains them in Egypt. Even Lot, who's traveling with him, has so many possessions. Chapter 14, Lot gets taken captive. So Abraham comes up with 308. Do you understand when I talk about grocery stores and gas stations and all this property? He's got 318 men protecting it. These are 318 trained militants that are protecting. Abraham's just not an old man with an old wife and a camel wandering around in a desert. He's got people on staff. When he leaves Haran, he's left with more people. He's putting people on staff. You think Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump, who's got a lot of money, but he's also got so many people working for him. They're on staff. Why? Can't he take care of himself? No, there's so much stuff. That's not a campaign slogan or speech, but just consider that. So he's got 318 men that are just there for protection. In chapter 21, the local chieftain, which would be the Philistines, does the same thing. He says, at that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, said to Abram, God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore, swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my descendants or my posterity, but as I have dealt kindly with you, so you will deal with me and with the land where you have sojourned. In other words, the Philistines are intimidated. Listen, we'll treat you right, but don't be coming and invading us. Abraham's servant goes up to get Rebekah and proclaims Abraham's wealth to Rebekah. Basically says, I mean, you ought to see what he said. He's got a kingdom down there. He's like a kingdom just moving through Canaan. The Philistines envy Isaac's wealth in chapter 26. And Jacob leaves Laban with tremendous wealth and possessions in chapter 30. You can read about it, chapter 30 to 32. And then Joseph goes to Egypt and ends up, guess what? Running Egypt, bringing the whole family down, giving them the best part of the land. The whole family is blessed up until the time the Pharaoh is replaced. There's an overthrow in Egypt and a new Pharaoh takes place and doesn't remember anything about Joseph and his family or those that had come down from the land of Canaan, and they begin to oppress them. One of the reasons they begin to oppress them is they realize how powerful they are, how much influence, wealth that they have, and they begin to throw their babies, the baby boys, into the river, because it's like, these guys are powerful, and they put them in slavery. God comes and there's your deliverance of Exodus. So that very fact that they become, that second blessing, I will bless you, he's talking about financial, physical prosperity. Thus, be careful right there. Oh, if I follow God, I will also be as wealthy and as rich and have a nation just like Abraham. No, Paul, the apostle, followed him. He didn't even have a family, and he died a martyr, died broke, nothing. He wrote some letters, but he fulfilled God's plan. God's plan for Abraham is to become a great nation. So this would be included. God's plan for Paul was to become an apostle and proclaim Christ and write letters. So he was successful. But they didn't end up in the same financial or the same tax bracket, if you want to consider it that way. So be careful saying, well, look, he did that for Abraham, he'll do it for me. Well, maybe. But maybe he's going to do for you what he did for the apostle Paul. Have you die a martyr. It's like, well, I want to be Abraham. Well, that's where you don't get to choose. Tower of Babel tried to choose. Okay, third, your name will be great. The word for name is Shem. And this is exactly point C2. This is exactly what the builders of the Tower of Babel wanted. We will make a name for ourselves. We'll have a great name. God says, no, you won't, because you have not got the ability to work my plan. You're fallen, you're sinful, you've got your own agenda. You're going to become tyrants and oppress people. So he scattered them to save humanity. Now Abram, he says, I will make your name great. And the reason he's going to make his name great is he's going to be not a tyrant, but a blessing. And so Abraham, point three there, Abraham's great name is seen in his own time. The Pharaoh, the Philistines, the people in the land of Canaan, the four kings that came over to attack the five kings ended up being defeated by Abram and his 318 men. So the eastern kings found out how great a name Abram had. He was the father of many people groups. And we saw that last week on that genealogy chart. You've got just, you got the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites. Well, not the Moabites and Ammonites, they come from Lot. But you got the Amalekites. You've got all the Arabs coming through Ishmael. I mean, he's the father of not just Israel, but many other families and nations come from Abraham. The three largest religions today, name them, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. All three of them claim Abram as their father. As a Christian, this is my story. Abraham's story is the story of my religion. Well, if you're a Jew following Judaism, Abraham is definitely the father of your religion. Muslims claim Abraham through Ishmael the same way. So what I can say is Abraham's the father of my religion, so can Jews and Muslims. And you put Christians, Jews, and Muslims all together in a pie chart, and then all the other religions, I'm not sure, I'm making this up, but it would be something like this. This is the rest of the world religion. This is Christians, Muslims, and Jews making up this. And the two biggest ones are going to be Christians and the Muslims, who are about ready to take over Christianity sometime in our generation, the Jews. You're not going to have much, and this pie chart is not exact. But when you take these guys out, they follow Abraham, Abraham, Abraham. These are the people that don't follow Abraham. And there's probably someone there that claim it. So that is a great name. Kind of something the Tower of Babel wanted to attain. So that 4,000 years later, we'd still be saying names of the people of the Tower of Babel. We still follow their religion and their ways. David's house and the promises given to David, and of course the Messiah. The fourth, besides saying you're going to be a nation, you're going to be blessed, your name is going to be great, you will be a blessing, and that's a very general statement, but clear that Abraham, the intention for God doing this with Abraham was so that you will be a blessing to other people. You're not going to just accumulate, you're going to be a blessing. Then we've already talked about the next point, points 5 and 6, those who bless you, I'll bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. There's some more details there on 5 and 6. I think I pointed most of that out. And number 7, of course, and all the nations will be blessed through you. That's the big one. All the nations of the world that were scattered from the Tower of Babel, that God dispersed them, sent them off into obscurity, I'm going to bless them through you. All of them will be brought back to the Lord Jesus Christ through you. And that's number 7. So, chapter 12, verse 4, moving on quickly. I'm checking the clock right here. Okay, so Abraham went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Now, if some of you make a big deal about Lot going with him, he probably should have stayed because now he's dragging a little bit of his family along with him. I would say Lot shouldn't have gone with him, but it seems like with Haran dying, Abram's got its Terah, and he's got Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran has a son named Lot. Nahor's going to have Laban and Rebecca. Haran dies, and so Lot appears to come over here and live with Abraham. It looks like he almost adopted him, because when Abraham leaves, he takes his, quote, son with him. That's the best way to look at that, probably, because he has nowhere else to go. Now, when Abram eventually has a son named Isaac, he sends him back up to his home country to get Rebekah. When Rebekah has a son named Jacob, she sends him up to Uncle Laban, her brother, to get Rachel. And, of course, he gets Leah and Zilpha and Rachel, Zilpha, and Bilhah. Okay, going on. So he leaves, takes Lot with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And now on this next page, there's the rest of those verses we're going to read here. And there's your map. There's the full journey. Again, I apologize if you disagree with me that Ur is there. And Ur is there, north of Haran. There is a city, Ur, that you can work with. There's like 4 or 5 other choices for Ur, but that one matches. Of course, you've got your traditional one that's down here, Persian Gulf, Tigris, Euphrates River, Ur. That was excavated by, Dr. Woolley, I think in the 1890s, early 1900s, and they decided that was where Abraham came from. Ur of the Chaldeans is in Mesopotamia, between the rivers. There. Okay, now, the Ur up here by Haran and Haran is also up here. The evidence we have that this is the land of Abraham's family is when they go get a wife for Rachel, they don't go up and come down to Ur, or when Jacob flees to his family, he doesn't flee up and down to Ur. They all go up here, and this is where they come to. Now, if Abraham's family followed him up here, then this is not their home. This, their home country would be here. They just followed Abraham on his migration. So I would think, again, and that's a decision I've made, and that's why I've made the map this way. If you disagree with that, we can all agree Ur's down here then. Story's the same, it's just where are they going? Only it changes is my maps. Okay, and Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered and the people that they had acquired in Haran. See that? They go from Ur to Haran, and while they're in Haran, they're already gathering possessions and, notice, people. And those people would, you can, that slavery, indentured servants, that was all part of the culture. It could be security. It could be laborers. It could be shepherds. They're people that are on staff, on some probably different levels. He's got one, Eliezer is his chief servant, which means he's his visor. He's his vice president. He's the one who takes care of everything. He makes all the decisions for Abraham. And so the people would rank from probably slaves, household slaves, to shepherds that are working the fields. And we know he's got 318 military personnel to protect all of his stuff. And we know he's got a top servant who's his advisor or his visor taking care of, you know, his business. Running, has his checkbook, has his seal. If he's got a seal to sign things like Jacob is going to have or Judah is going to have. Abraham's going to have, they use seals. I've got seals from this time period that people would use to roll their name, and they wore them around their neck, or they could wear them on a ring. Abraham had a seal, but probably one of his servants had his signature that he could sign documents with. So from the lowest servant all the way up to someone that's got his seal, he acquired more people. Okay. That they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. And then you can see the land of Canaan, they're going down probably to Aleppo, down to Hamath. Now they're going through Aram, down to Riblah. They probably went either way, whatever Ur you're coming from, you're going down that, because you're in Haran, and you're coming down that same road. So our stories have all met. Wherever you put Ur, you're coming down this road, because now you're leaving Haran, and you're in Riblah. Now you're in Damascus, going by Dan, like we saw a picture of a gate that Abraham would have passed by from the land of Dan, or the city of Dan, gone to Hazor, Megiddo, and that's in right by through the valley of Jezreel, and down to Shechem. And that's where our story is going to pick up here. Chapter 12, verse 6. Abram passed through the land of the place, through the land to the place at Shechem. And notice this, to Shechem. Really, that's a big map. See that? But now you get to Shechem. They're not just going to say Shechem. They're going to talk about a tree at Shechem. So you got here. You got the whole map, the whole Middle East. And then you get to Shechem, and now we're talking about a tree. So Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Morah. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. So when he arrives, he got all these promises. Oh my gosh, this land's not empty. There's people occupying it. There's cities, there's Hy-Vees, there's gas stations. There's people running. The fields are already being planted and harvested and grazed by. Well, what am I going to do? Well, then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring, I will give this land. Now notice right there, at that time the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and says, to your offspring, I will give this land. It's Canaanites. Don't be confused. I'm going to give this land to your offspring. Now he doesn't say, kill all these people and take over. He's leading him through this land. Again, I'm going to draw my map up here. Give him. There's Jerusalem. It's not a big deal here in our story yet. But here's Bethel. And then over, excuse me. Here's Shechem. Then right over here is going to be Bethel and Ai. And right here, he comes down here. He comes into the land. He's in the heart of the land in the hill country right here. And he sees there's Canaanites everywhere. And God says to him, to your offspring I'll give this land. Now later on, he's going to tell them, your offspring will go to Egypt and be in Egypt for four generations. Because the sin of the Amorites, or the Canaanites, is not yet full. God is planning. He knows this culture. There's believers in this culture, apparently. They have contracts. They have treaties with Abram. They honor, there's idols in this land, but there's also believers apparently in this land. But it's going to decline about the time that Joseph gets to Egypt. There's going to be one, two, three, four generations of decline here. And at the end of that four generations, it's 1406, and it's time for Joshua to come in to Jericho and begin driving these people out. Now that's, again, notice that. This is around 2000, we'll just say 2100, 2000 BC. Joshua's going to come in 1406 BC. So we're talking about 600 years. That countdown doesn't begin until the 1800s when they go to Egypt. Joseph and Jacob go into Egypt, and then there's going to be one, two, three, four generations. In those days, a generation was 100 years. Whoops, that's 1,000. I would say generations in our time are 40 years because lifespans have changed, and the Bible supports that. So 1800 to 17 to 16 to 15 to 1400, there's your one, two, three, four generations. Josh is coming into the land to establish the nation in the land. And he's coming after getting law from Moses. Abraham receives the promise. They end up in Egypt. They come out after four generations of being in Egypt. Moses gives them the law. Joshua takes the land. And so right here, that's what that means right here. The Canaanites were in the land. Abraham passed through the land to the place of Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So, because God says, "I give you this land," he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. Now we know from Stephen's speech that the Lord had appeared to Abram in Ur of the Chaldeans, in the land on the other side of the Euphrates. Up there on that map, if you want to consider that, there it is. The Lord of glory appeared to our father Abram. Now he has gone to Haran, he's gone through this, and now the Lord appears to him at Shechem and says, "This is your land, I'm giving it to your offspring." And Abram builds an altar. Now, this altar that is built, it doesn't say he offered sacrifices. It could, again, I'm reading into the story, and I'll show you. This probably is an altar to the Lord, but it's a claim to the promise. He's building an altar here. He's going to build an altar over here between Bethel and Ai. He's going to build it in the south. He's claiming this land. This is like a monument to God made me a promise. This is my land. He doesn't need a bird offering, a lamb offering. He doesn't need a sacrifice. He needs a marker. This is my land. So that is probably what's taking place right there. Let's go down and look at some things right here on these notes. Page 6. The first thing, three specific places are mentioned in the land of Canaan, and only three. Shechem, and then the place between Bethel and Ai, and then the Negev, which is where Hebron is at. Those are what is mentioned. These same three are mentioned again, these same three places are mentioned with Abraham entering the land. They're mentioned with Jacob when he returns with his four wives and his sons. When he comes back, Jacob is mentioned. And they're mentioned again when Joshua takes the land. And I don't have time to do this justice, so we'll just take a quick look at this. Jacob, visited by Jacob when he returns from Haran with his wives, the same places. Shechem, Bethel and Ai, and the Negev. So, number one, Jacob goes to Shechem and purchases a section of a field, sets his tent, and builds an altar to God, the God of Israel, in Shechem when he returns. And here's the verses right here. Here Jacob commands his family to put away the idols. Now they've just come back from Paddan Aram, from being with Laban. And he comes across, he's met Esau, had his encounter with Esau, comes across and goes to Shechem. At Shechem, here it is, he says, tell his families, which would be Rachel, to all the sons, to put away the idols that are in their midst at Shechem. Now, there appears possibly to be two sets of idols. There's going to be idols here at Shechem that belong to the Canaanites, possibly. Meaning they're there of the people. Then they're there in their own, I'll just say Jacob's idols. They're not his idols, they're his family's idols. Now, there may just be Jacob's family's idols, but there's idols here. But because they're coming here to Shechem, which is a holy place, a sacred place from ancient times, and there's a picture again on page 8. This picture right here is Shechem. This is some kind of the remains of a temple, and it was built up over time, and there's a stone still standing there. And I got to see it. I took all these pictures. I was amazed that it was there. There's a standing stone. I've got it. You can still see it. There's a line I've got drawn to it. This is in the book of Judges. This is the Baal Bereth is the temple fortress. And there's Mount Ebal rising on the right side, Mount Gerizim rising on the left. Joshua comes back to this very place where there's a standing stone. Now, Jacob, right here, we're going to go back. That's where he's at. He's right here. This is where he's at. And that's probably where Abraham went. And that's probably some kind of a altar, holy place. And there's a tree there, the tree of Moreh. It's probably an oak tree. The oak tree itself wasn't sacred, but it's probably a marker, or this group of trees that were here was a place where people came to worship, to offer sacrifices. And those trees obviously are gone, but it's that tree of Moreh is mentioned several times. If I read through this, I will be able to show it to you several times. But here it is. At Shechem, at that very place I showed you that picture, you know, back in, you know, 1900 B.C., Jacob comes back here. Abraham's coming here today in, you know, 2000 B.C. He says, put away your foreign gods that are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments. Here Jacob commands his family to then bury their idols under the oak tree, apparently the idols that were brought from Aram that had been stolen from Uncle Laban. It says, so they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had and the rings that were in their ears. Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree that was near Shechem. And the terebinth tree is the same word that's translated oak tree. So Abram comes to Shechem under the oak tree and builds an altar, basically claiming the land. God, it's in honor of God's promise, I give you this land. So Abraham puts up a land marker. This is my land. Now, if you're offering a sacrifice on it, it doesn't say that. You're going to assume that he's putting a sacrifice on it. Jacob comes back to the very same place, and there, at the very same tree, they dig a hole and bury their idols, possibly burying all the other idols around Shechem. You say, how would they dare start messing with the holy site of the Canaanites? Well, you got to read the story of Jacob. They're not afraid. People are terrified of Jacob and his sons. This is not your Sunday school story. When Jacob comes across here with his sons, people are terrified. I mean, they'll slit your throat. They'll take your stuff. They'll kill you. I mean, they met Esau. Jacob's already wrestled with the angel of the Lord, met Esau, gave him a bunch of gifts so he'd go away, comes back. Well, let's read some more. In Genesis 34:25, Jacob's sons take vengeance on the men of Shechem. In chapter 34, the men of Shechem, one of the kings, the leader of Shechem, his son rapes Jacob's daughter, Diana. And they're like furious. And you know the story. And so they approach the men, the boys, Jacob's sons, they approach, say, hey, we have this conflict. But why don't we do it this way? Why don't we make a treaty with each other? You can have some of our stuff. We'll do business with you. We can buy and sell. And all the men of Shechem get together and go, this is a great deal. These guys are crazy rich. If they'll do business with us, it's going to put us in a whole other tax bracket. So they go, okay, we'll get into a treaty. They go, we're pretty stiff on this one issue, pretty strict. We have to be circumcised. Are you guys circumcised? It's like, well, no. Sorry, there's no way we can have a treaty with an uncircumcised people. Well, we could get circumcised. Well, yeah, sure. So all the men of Shechem take turns circumcising. These are not babies. These are men taking turns circumcising each other. And the sons of Jacob wait until they say the third day. You know, that's when the infection's setting in. And they go, well, your sword's sharp. And they attack the men of Shechem and slaughter them all for raping their sister, Dinah. And that's in Genesis 34:25. Jacob's sons take vengeance on the men of Shechem. So that is what's taking place there at Shechem. Also, John 4:4 through 5, Jacob dug a well here in the land taken from the Amorites. This is eventually, this land of Shechem, this place right here, is taken by Jacob. Now, some of these details, we just got references. It's like a story that everybody knew, and they say, you know, when Jacob did this, or Jacob says he's going to give this land, Jacob on his deathbed is going to give this land to Joseph, the land that I took from the men of Shechem with my sword. It's like, what? Or the land I bought. It's like, when is all these things happening? So there's things happening here. We know one account where they killed the men of Shechem. We know this account right here because John records it. He, Jesus, left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. Shechem is in Samaria. He's going from Jerusalem up to Galilee, Jesus is. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar. Now, Sychar is Shechem in the New Testament. Near the field, watch, where is the Sychar? Near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. So there's a field here that Jacob gives to Joseph that's near Shechem that Jacob says, I took it from the Amorites. I took it myself. Well, there that's where Jacob's well's at. There's a well that Jacob dug. So Jacob digs a well there. It's called Jacob's Well. We've been there. Can't take pictures of it, though. You got to buy a postcard. So I took a postcard and took a picture of the postcard. Okay, but anyway, I want to take a picture. They wouldn't let you. I'm sure I could have done it, but I thought, holy place, didn't want to do it. So I didn't take a picture of it. Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. And this is where the Samaritan woman comes out of Sychar, and she meets Jesus at Jacob's well right here in the same place. Now again, I'm just getting started on this. Genesis 48:14, Jacob gives this specific ridge or slope of the mountain to Joseph and Joshua. This is where Joshua brings Joseph's bones and buries them on that plot of land his father Jacob gave him that Jacob took from Shechem. That's where Joseph's bones are buried in 1406 BC. So all of this, we're just getting started, but Abraham comes in and goes to Shechem and builds an altar there by the tree of Moreh, which is probably an oak tree, which is probably a holy site, which we've got a picture of. And then Jacob's going to come later and set up a stone. I'll have to clean this up next week. I appreciate your patience, but we got to quit out of respect for the reality. And Tony, I'm taking her out to eat tonight, so I got to go. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the plan that you have. We think that we can be part of the plan that you're working on. Live a life that is dedicated to you and to be able to celebrate and anticipate the great things you're doing for us now and in the future. Again, we thank you for this opportunity and ask that we may be a blessing to all the nations by being able to share your word and share a testimony of Jesus Christ with our things we say and the way we live. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.